Radio EcoShock.
Top scientists warn humans must start removing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere or we could encounter a climate catastrophe. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change assumes we will use so-called carbon capture and storage. But where is the technology to do it? Nothing reliable has appeared until now. A project in Iceland has discovered a way to convert carbon dioxide into stone in less than 2 years. That's fantastic news. It's a game changer, but it has limitations. Let's discover what this new tech called CarbFix is all about. Our guest is a co-author of a new paper published in the journal Science on June 10, 2016. The title is Rapid Carbon Mineralization for Permanent Disposal of Anthropogenic Carbon Dioxide Emissions. Dr. Martin Stute was educated at Heidelberg University. He is now professor of environmental science at Barnard College, Columbia University in New York, and a hydrologist at Columbia University's Lamont-Doherty Earth Observatory. Martin Stute, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
It's exciting news. We're not talking about a theory or a model, but a carbon storage process that has already worked. Have you held a piece of this new carbon stone in your hand? What is it like?
Yes, I have. Actually, the first time we saw it was in a monitoring well. So we are injecting the CO2 with water at one place, and it flows through the subsurface. And then the reactions happen. And then we have a monitoring well, another hole in the ground where we have pumps, and we pump up water to the surface and monitor the composition of this water to find out what's happening. And what happened is that the pump failed. So that was the first time we saw it. We pulled out the pump, and the inside of the pump and on the outside of the pump and on the pipes, there was a white material that looks like if you pour sugar on a surface, so small crystals. And then, of course, we analyzed these crystals right away, and we noticed that these crystals are carbonate minerals, you know, same material that seashells are made of. And then we knew that these minerals are forming in the system, so we are converting CO2 into minerals.
And where is this all taking place?
So this is taking place maybe 30 kilometers east of Reykjavik, the capital of Iceland, and it's very close to a geothermal power plant. And we are using gases that are released currently from this power plant to the air, and we pipe that to a site a few kilometers away, and then we inject it close by into a basalt formation. Now, you would think that maybe geothermal power plants should not emit anything. You know, they are very green, renewable energy, and so on. But the reason why they emit CO2 is that the very hot water that they convert into steam that then drives the turbine also contains CO2 from very deep in the earth. This is a volcanic area, and there is CO2, and the CO2 is in the water, in the steam, and currently gets released into the atmosphere. So the Icelanders wanted to not emit the CO2 to help prevent climate change, and they decided to invest into a technology to get rid of it.
And could you describe for us sort of a brief step-by-step of capturing and storing carbon dioxide at this plant?
So the capture process is actually fairly easy in this situation, because the gases come out of the turbine, and we can actually use the gases almost as they are. There's a little bit of treatment of the gas, so there's some hydrogen in there that we reduce the concentration of in a very fast process in the power plant. And then the remaining gases, which is mostly CO2 and hydrogen sulfide in this particular case, it's this rotten egg smell. So these two gases then go through a pipeline, and they go to a well a few kilometers away. They are pumped down through a pipeline, through a tube, into the well. And then at the same time, we are pumping water through another pipe also into the well. And then at depth, like in an aquarium, we have a sparger or, you know, bubble stone that you would buy for an aquarium. Of course, it's much bigger in this case. The CO2 bubbles out of one pipe and then mixes with the water that we pumped at the same time. So by the time that this mixture enters the formation, you know, the basalt formation, the CO2 is completely dissolved in the water. There are no bubbles left, which prevents any CO2 from leaking upward, which can be a problem at conventional CO2 sequestration or CO2 storage sites, because as long as CO2 is in gas phase, it can move upwards, of course, like bubbles would in a glass of seltzer water. the chances that they would reach the surface at these other sites are extremely small, but it's not zero. So in our case, we dissolve the CO2 right away in the water, and then there's no incentive for the CO2 to move upwards anymore. And then, of course, in the second step, the CO2 reacts with the basaltic rock and forms these carbonates that then stay behind as initially small crystals, which will grow over time in the rock.
That's pretty clear. Now, the key to it is this rock called basalt. What is that?
So it's a volcanic rock. You know, consider it, it's basically lava flows in Iceland. You know, there are lots of volcanoes in Iceland. There were recent eruptions, as you know. Over the years, thousands of years, there were many eruptions, so there are lots of layers of this lava, and the formation of this kind of rock is called basalt. And it is very fresh, and it has this property that it reacts with CO2 also under natural conditions, so it forms carbonates. But we all thought that this would be a very slow process, and perhaps we couldn't use this to actually engineer it to deposit CO2. But this experiment showed that actually this can work on a very short time scale, very fast, much faster than we all anticipated.
And Martin, as we learned from your paper in Science, another required component is lots of water. Previously, water wasn't considered important in carbon capture and storage. How much water is required, and could seawater be used?
I think we don't really know the answer yet. No field experiment has been done, but it's likely it will work. There are some hints that it will work. But of course, one has to really try it, as we did in Iceland in the real world, and perhaps inject CO2 dissolved in seawater into a basalt, which could be an ocean floor basalt. I mean, that's the ocean floors is the place on the Earth where the basalt is very common. 90% of the ocean floor or more is basalt. So if we could figure out how to do this on the ocean floor, that would really be fantastic, you know, because we had an unlimited reservoir of basalt. If we just would have to get the CO2 to the oceans, and that would be a problem, potentially, you know, if it's far away. But there are many coastal areas that have basalt just offshore, and there are many power plants near the coastlines because power plants want to be where people are, and people like to be near coastlines. But I think it's a little bit too early to tell if this works or not, because it has to be really tried in a pilot experiment similar to the one in Iceland.
Yeah, when I was looking into this, I noticed previous research into storing carbon dioxide under the sea in basalt. For example, there's a 2008 paper, Carbon Dioxide Sequestration in Deep Sea Basalt by Goldberg et al.
Right.
But now you've added some new twists to this, especially the injection of water. And so this is a little bit different from what they had envisioned, is it?
I mean, what they are envisioning is all theory right at this point in time. So it's an idea that would have to be tested. I think they were considering not only CO2 dissolved in water injections, but they were thinking also of injection of CO2, pure CO2. But because there's water in these formations anyway, the reactions might work in a similar way. I guess we need to find out. We don't know for sure.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. And some other countries who could use it. Could America do it?
Yeah, I mean, there are the biggest basalt occurrence in the United States is the Columbia River basalt in Washington State. So that would be a potential location. There are basalts offshore of New York City, actually, off the west coast of the United States. And then within the country, there are several spots as well. So about 10% of the continental rocks are basalts.
And how about India, for example?
India is another big basalt occurrence. So that has also been proposed in previous papers to study that place.
And you moved the CO2 in a pipeline. Could we picture some way of transporting the CO2 from power plants that aren't near basalt to remote locations and then store it the way CarbFix is doing?
Yeah, we could envision that. It just will add significantly to the cost of the technology.
And can bacteria get into this carbon-loaded rock and destabilize it?
There's no evidence for that yet. So there are groups that are studying this. So certainly the role of life in this process is probably underappreciated and has not been studied as much because it's very complicated. There are so many different kinds of microbes that live down there. But there is a group associated with the CarbFix program that does just that, and they are studying the role of microbes in these systems. So they may be important. We don't know for sure yet.
And the other big news, which you've mentioned in this CarbFix story, is how quickly that CO2 morphed into a stable stone. Could you tell us a little bit more about that, what the previous expectations were and what happened?
Yeah, so the previous expectations were that this would take a very long period of time, hundreds of years, maybe longer than that. Then people started to do laboratory experiments, and they actually found out that it's significantly faster than that. And then there was a modeling study a few years ago that took the composition of this local basalt and, you know, a lot of information that had been gathered in laboratory experiments for many years, and they predicted that it would take about 10 years. But the scientific community just didn't believe that paper. It was actually a little difficult to publish because they just didn't believe that this could happen that fast. And then it actually happened in 2 years. So much faster even than that. Why that is, we speculate in the paper. We have some ideas why it could be. We may underestimate, for example, the surface area of the rocks. Part of that might have been a dissolution of existing carbonates through our injections that then were deposited someplace else. So there are several theories why what happened, but we actually have a difficult time at the moment to differentiate between them. So we need further studies to figure this out.
And of course, the worry, Martin, with any good news about carbon capture and storage is that the public will run away with it. People may think it's okay to pollute now because scientists have a permanent solution. Do you worry about that?
I do, yes. And I want to be clear and say this is not a silver bullet. I think we have to invest in lots of different approaches, you know, switching to renewable energy. We need to be more efficient. We need to look at other carbon sequestration techniques, and this could play a major role in this whole discussion, but it's not a silver bullet. It's not solving our problems. You know, it's rather, I think we have to push these other technologies as fast as we can, but we feel like we cannot really displace fossil fuel energy sources very rapidly. We should do it as fast as we can, but it's not going to happen overnight. And while in this transition period, this technology could be very relevant. And also, I wanted to mention one other thing. You know, we may even underestimate the damaging effects of climate change. Who knows? You know, people usually claim that it doesn't exist and we are overestimating it. But the other thing could happen too. Maybe we underestimate it. And maybe we have to, at some point in the future, remove CO2 from the atmosphere just to reduce the levels, so capture CO2 from the air. And then this technology could be very relevant. You know, if it works in the oceans, we could actually capture CO2 out of the atmosphere on old drilling platforms maybe and inject the CO2 into nearby basalt formations. And then we could lower the CO2 levels. I don't know if we will have to get there. But if we do, you know, we better be ready to do this and make sure it works.
Yes, because scientists like James Hansen say we need to go back down to at least 350 parts per million of CO2 in order to maintain any sort of ice at the poles, and we need that in order to have our climate system, and on we go. Look, as an aside, can you tell us about your other research into ways to figure out the ancient past by analyzing current groundwater?
Oh, you're aware of that. So groundwater moves very slowly in the subsurface. So if you go a few hundred meters below ground and you are in an area, what we call a sedimentary basin, basically a bathtub filled with sediments, then since groundwater moves very slowly, you know, maybe a meter per year or something like that, if you know where your groundwater enters the subsurface and you have wells downstream, you can collect samples from these wells, and you can actually determine how old that water is that you sample in a well. And, you know, surprisingly, you find water that can be 10,000 years old, 20,000 years old or older. And that means a lot of this groundwater that we are drinking today is actually from 20,000 years ago. So it entered the ground that long time ago. And I took advantage in my earlier research on figuring out what we can learn about the past from these old groundwaters. So if I have a water sample from a well that's 20,000 years old, that water sample will record certain things that happened at the time when it was near the surface. For example, how cold or warm it was at the time, how much rain was falling at the time, etc., etc. There's a whole bunch of parameters one can look at. And the method that gave me the most interesting results is the dissolved gas content of this water, which actually allowed me to say how cold or warm it was at the time of recharge when this water entered the ground. And I was able to say, you know, 20,000 years ago, in this place in Brazil, for example, the temperature was 5 degrees C lower than it is today. So it allows me to measure the temperature in the past.
Wow. I think that's exciting stuff. And, you know, just as I could say that the water that I'm drinking is probably 20,000 years old. It's fossil water. And that means it's before the atomic residues from atomic testing and before chemicals that are polluting other people's water. So I'm happy to have it.
Yeah, it's not unusual that you drink water that is very, very old. The closest place from New York City is Atlantic City, New Jersey, right, where all the casinos are. And that water that is coming out of a fountain in a casino in Atlantic City is 20,000 years old.
Amazing. So with this CarbFix project, are you excited to be involved with something that might actually help us prevent a climate disaster, even a little?
How can I say no? Of course. Yeah, I'm very excited about this. Yeah. So it's a big step forward. And in the life of a scientist, this doesn't happen very often, that you feel like you have been part of a discovery that could make a big difference.
We've been talking with Dr. Martin Stute from Columbia University. He co-authored the paper, Rapid Carbon Mineralization for Permanent Disposal of Anthropogenic Carbon Dioxide Emissions. You can find links to all this in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. Martin, thank you for telling us a little good news for a change.
Oh, you're welcome. It was a pleasure.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.